Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Guys, welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I've got a great guest today, Simon Kethlen Jones. And Simon, I would have gotten your middle name wrong if your team had not told me the correct pronunciation. I don't know if that is a British pronunciation or...
Well, it's somewhat British. You did great, by the way. It's Kethlen Jones, and it is from Wales.
Wales.
I have some Welsh blood, yeah.
Guys, Simon has a rap sheet that's extremely long from war correspondent, which, I mean, the fact that you went into production, you traveled to, I think it was Russia, Afghanistan in the early days. You've seen war up close, but Simon is an award-winning director, and I'll just read off a few. One, you know, Simon and I were talking before we started, but he did Generation Kill, which was an amazing series. It was an HBO series. Correct?
That's exactly right. Yep.
Yeah. Generation Kill was about 1st Recon Battalion during the ground war, the offensive into Iraq in 2003. And it was my old platoon. Gunny Wynn was my platoon sergeant at one point. I was young. I was a corporal at that time. But you did a fabulous job sort of depicting the special operators within 1st Recon Battalion. That was dear to my heart. And then, you know, Boardwalk Empire, The Expanse, Ballers, which I binged out on. I think there anyone who got into Ballers with The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, Shooter, C with Jason Momoa, and you've got one coming out March 15th, which I got a pre-screener of Arthur the King. And whenever you combine adventure racing, just a feel-good story with dogs, my wife and I were glued. It was a tearjerker, and it was good. Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm really proud of it.
So, Simon, give us your background, because, you know, one, I'd say movies, production, directing are in your blood. You know, your father introduced you early on, but just give the audience your background, born, raised, and what led you to this point.
Yeah, my first job in the movies was as a mailboy at 20th Century Fox in London, which was the sort of bottom of the ladder job. Believe me, it was cleaning the lavatories, it was delivering film around Soho. Then I did a few things, then I went to the glorious BBC, which I just still love. It's amazing. It's like our PBS, but more so. And they sort of trained me to do loads of things. And then I just took the leap, made my own little film, and threw myself into the freelance world, and so far I'm still here.
This younger generation, which in this generation, it seems like people want to come in fast and they want to you know, skip a few steps. From somebody who started in the mailroom, you know, what do you often tell the young, ambitious people that are coming into this industry that, hey, you got to start at the bottom and you got to work your way to the top?
I sort of say, you know, you can start. I think it's great to start at the bottom, but if you know, or wherever you start, if you get yourself a little bit of experience, I think just working hard is a good thing. I'm sorry, I'm sounding like an old fart here, but you know, yeah. I think that's the right way. And the next thing I'd say to those people trying to cut some corners or whatever, these days you guys have got these things. They make films, so everybody has the means to make the film now. I had to hire a camera and spend tens of thousands of dollars on film stock But now you could make one in your garden. And I think that's a great thing.
That, you know, it's like the military. You don't come in at the top. You got to work your way to the, you got to work your way to every rank or every position. And there is, I think there's more appreciation for the path when you do that.
Yeah. I really think so. I started directing pretty young, but even so, it felt like I just worked like a dog for years, which I did. And, you know, maybe that's that toughened me up, or maybe, I don't know, but it feels like I'm not complaining about when things go well, because I remember when they went badly.
Did you feel like you had higher expectations placed on you because you came with your father's background?
Possibly, I guess so. And, you know, you always get the Nepo kids accusation. You know, sometimes that makes you work harder. Because, you know, people don't give you jobs because of who your folks are anymore. You know, because they're spending millions of dollars and they want a budget, they want a schedule, they want it done properly. They don't do people favors anymore.
So you got to explain to me, you know, you said you started out and then you broke off and you actually went to Beirut, Russia, Afghanistan, capturing war up close. That seems like a pretty big leap from what you
were doing. It was a weird thing, and I did it in dribs and drabs. I had my best friend was a newspaper reporter, and he started off in Beirut working for the Beirut Daily Star, and then after a while he got a job at the Times of London, you know, a big fat newspaper. And I would, you know, every now and then he would say, "Hey, I'm going to Afghanistan for a week. Do you want to come?" And I'd go, "Wow, I'm free. Yeah, why not?" And so, you know, we wouldn't be being bombed and shot at the whole time. But, you know, it was a little bit lively.
Do you think that shaped your approach to filmmaking? I know, especially with Generation Kill, having experienced war up front, do you think that, I'll say, armed you to better portray the realities of war?
Well, I would say so. Because, you know, again, I'm not putting myself as this guy who was, you know, on the front lines with you guys in First Recon, for example. But, yeah, you learn a lot. You see people under pressure. You realize that you've got to grab a photograph or you've got to grab a moment because it's just, you know, in real life, you can't do retakes.
No, you can't. You can't. And I know after you came out of that, one of your first major roles was production runner in 1984, which was a massive hit. That must have been a massive learning curve for you.
Yeah, that was.
What falls under a production runner?
Well, it's making people tea, photocopying the script and the budget. But that's the interesting thing. You know, you photocopy the budget. And you're obviously, when you're photocopying the budget, it's a secret document, but you're going to look at it. And you learn so much from just reading stuff I was photocopying.
Where was it? What was the biggest learning curve?
The biggest learning curve was seeing people get fired for dumb reasons. And, you know, you just have to keep your head down a little bit. You have to be nice. I think, you know, a good thing that's happened in our business, it hasn't fixed the problem, but, you know, this whole Me Too situation has made a lot of people think twice. Before they behave like an asshole or before they do other stuff. And I think, you know, it's a collaborative medium making films. And just like, I mean, not just like being a soldier, but if you're a soldier, particularly, you really need your buddies behind you and beside you. That's the whole point of it, isn't it?
You know, you bring that up, and I know that is a touchy subject with Harvey Weinstein. You know, people love to paint in broad brushstrokes. Did that really place a bad image on Hollywood altogether? I mean, was that something you guys had to combat? That, hey, no, that behavior is isolated to certain people. That's not the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bad thing. It was some brave journalists. You know, there were very powerful people like Harvey Weinstein, but other people as well, who just, you know, a lot of people say, well, that's the patriarchy for you. But it's, you know, a lot of stuff happened that was just like outrageous. And then suddenly people started speaking up. And I'm not saying it's fixed the problem, obviously, but I do think people think twice now before you know, behaving badly or, you know, being mean to people.
Yeah. It's, you know, that, and that's not just Hollywood. I'm speaking to the choir here. Power corrupts, absolutely. And that's every industry. Somebody gets that amount of power, they feel that they're untouchable. And all of a sudden that their behaviors are beyond reproach. And that's tragic. So I've got to ask, I mean, you worked with, well, I should say some of the top actors in the world have worked with you.
Thank you.
Dwayne Johnson. I mean, he looks like the nicest guy. Is he truly just a joy to work with? And I mean, Mark Wahlberg sort of falls into that same category.
Mark Wahlberg is just fantastic. I mean, you know, some of these people, they're movie stars for a reason. You know, they have that thing that you can't really describe. They have that thing when the camera switches on, their face just changes a tiny bit. I don't know what it is. And, you know, I've done two films on the bounce now with Mark Wahlberg. And, you know, he's pretty much at the top of his art, top of his craft. He's a producer. He's a multi-hyphenate, you know, all of that. He's an entrepreneur. But what he does is he, when he likes a role, he commits. That's one of the things I like most about him is he comes in. He doesn't just phone it in. He comes in and he does it for real. And I'm so grateful for that.
So is that the difference between top actors and I guess all the rest is you just see a level of commitment that they totally own the role, that they stop everything else and focus on that?
I think that's what the good ones do. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's people out there who get well paid and show their face and then sort of go off and do another project and good luck to them. But, you know, people like Mark Wahlberg, I think, you know, and, you know, The Rock and Jason Momoa, these guys, they love movies. They feel pretty blessed. They don't take their stuff for granted. They don't take the people they work with for granted. And, you know, they just go, wow, I'm still doing it. I just hope it carries on.
So I've got to ask this. You know, I've gotten to become very close with Dan Myrick, who was the producer-director of the Blair Witch Project. And we've worked on a number of documentaries now. And the documentaries are different because it's a fly on the wall. But he said when you're running a major film and you're directing and you're filming, he said now that he knows the military, he said it's a small military operation. Give us a sense of what goes into that. I mean, are you on edge when you're filming? Because I know you've got to stay within budget. You've got to stay on time. Things come up. Locations weren't properly coordinated. What is it to direct a film? What is it like to run those operations?
It's really cool. It's fun. It is a little scary. I mean, the last one I did had a pretty high budget the before that. And then the Arthur the King, you know, again, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but it's like, it's my first movie and am I going to screw it up? So you have all that, but it's so exhilarating. And once you get over that sort of, you know, awestruckness about the problems, it's just the coolest job in the world.
And I can assume everyone is looking at you when you are leading these. I mean, everyone is looking to you for the answers, guidance. Do you feel that way as a leader?
Yeah, I think what you have to do as a director is, you know, different people are different. Some of them want to control every tiny thing. That's not what I do. But I do think you have to have a plan. I think, you know, if you're going to work with someone like Mark Wahlberg and you turn up on set and not what you're doing, you know, he's a nice guy, but he's going to go, what's going on? You know, what are we doing? So I think, yeah, having a plan and, you know, sometimes having an idea, whatever the idea is the right thing to do because it's an idea. So people go, okay, we'll do that. And then you go, oh, shit, I hope it works, but at least they stopped asking me questions.
Getting to Arthur the King, first off, give us why you signed up for this project. Where you guys filmed, everything that went into it. Cause I mean, watching it, it seems like that would be a logistical nightmare just to pull off a film like this.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. We filmed it during COVID. We filmed it in a beautiful country called the Dominican Republic, which is a big island in the Caribbean. And the outside of it is beautiful, expensive holiday resorts with beaches. And you go sort of half a mile inland and it's just jungle and small towns and stuff. So logistically, it was incredible. We had to you know, leave at 5 o'clock in the morning, strap all our gear to four-wheel drive, sometimes put it on a helicopter, sometimes put it on a zip line. And it was a logistical nightmare, but again, that's part of the challenge, it's part of the fun. And we were working with people, again, who were very committed. So it ended up being super fun.
I've got to assume you guys try to give back to the community as much as possible. Are you hiring locals when you guys are doing that as much as possible?
We're actually hiring a very large amount of locals. Yes. I mean, we bring in some key crew. But yeah, we're staying in hotels there. We're spending money on their equipment places and on their people, their caterers and stuff like that. So, you know, I think they give a tax rebate. So there's always sort of each way incentives. But, you know, that's one of the things I love working in a place like the Dominican Republic. It does have an infrastructure, but, you know, the people are fairly new to it. So you just got to put yourself in their hands.
So were you approached on this film, or had you read the book, The Dog Who Crossed the Jungle to Find a Home?
No, I was approached. I was approached at quite short notice. And Mark Wahlberg was already involved. And they kind of were pretty much ready to go. And then COVID kept bouncing everything around. And I sort of swept in and loved the project. I mean, I've got three dogs, too many, obviously. But still, I love dogs. And the dog we had in this movie, which was in a way the co-star, was fantastic. You know, you hear the thing, don't work with dogs and kids, but this dog was great.
Hey, I tell you what, man, the dog, one, my wife and I are dog people. We
okay,
we
good.
More than humans. So that's what attracted us. But what do you think what are people going to walk away from this film? And what do you think it reinforces just in life?
Well, there you go. I mean, I guess the message of the film is it's twofold. First of all, never give up, which, believe me, I've given up several times, and we've all done it. So it's easy for me to say. And the second thing I would say is that there is more than one way to win a race. You know, you can cross the finish line the first, and that's cool, and that means you've won the race. But you know, you're racing against yourself, you're racing with your team, and you can win by you can win by never giving up.
And this story emphasizes that to the heart. It definitely pulls in the heartstrings.
Good. Good. You know, I hope I had you a little worried.
Are you most excited about this one? And of course, you know, you got to say that. But is this one of the most favorite projects you've ever probably worked on?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, as I said, I've been lucky because I've done two films in a row with Mark Wahlberg. And they've both been extraordinary. The one before was called which in fact we filmed afterwards, was called The Family Plan.
Yes.
Which was a sort of big action comedy.
Came out
in December, just before Christmas. That's right.
My wife and I watched it right when it came out. Great. Remind me, that was released on Netflix?
Apple.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, I do. I love this film because it's kind of my first movie, really. I mean, I did it a couple of years ago, smaller ones. But this is one where I went, wow, this is your shot, you know, Simon. Don't screw it up. So the fact that it went okay was just such a relief that will make it always dear to my heart.
Is there a leap between doing series and doing a full movie production?
Yeah, there is. In a series, quite reasonably, they're kind of more run by the writers. So the writers like the producer and stuff like that, because you've got lots of directors, unless you're doing a pilot. But when you get to a film, of course I have bosses. There are people above me, like the heads of the studio and stuff. Always. There's always someone in charge above you, isn't there? But a lot of it's on me. And what happens, I think, in a movie is people leave you alone when it's going okay. Mm. And when they're not happy with things, you damn well hear about it.
It's like the little monkey on your shoulder trying to
oh, yeah.
With COVID, were there, I've got to assume there were constraints on you that you had to deal with that you hadn't dealt with before?
Yeah, there were, and the studio and the producers were very tough about them. They said, no one screws around with this. You've got to do it. You don't like it, tough. And you have, you're wearing masks the whole time. We've been tested 3 times a week. We have a whole COVID department, you know, politely but insistently telling you to put your mask on. If people take it off and put it back, you know. So it was, you know, it was difficult. We have to sort of only certain amount of people in a van, and you, when you eat, you can't eat in a tent. You have to eat sort of outside. But you know, it was very well run, the film, very well managed, and it got done without anything serious screwing up.
Simon, you know, before we close out, we ask all our guests, which are high performers, and you're a high performing with performer within your industry. You know, what are some of the, two-part question? What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned along the way, and what are the keys to success that you sort of equate that have led you to all the great accomplishments in your life?
Well, I do think that it's important to treat the people you work with well, partly because that's what a human does, but also selfishly, you want to get the best out of them. You want them to feel confident and excited and enthusiastic. So I think I don't have many abilities, but I do have a bit of energy, and I do have a sort of enthusiasm for what I do. So that's been a big life lesson for me, is that, you know, what you take out is what you put in.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, again, Arthur the King comes out March 15th. My wife and I will help you, even though we've seen the screener. We'll definitely, there's nothing like going to the movies, which, you know, that's a topic. You know, nothing replaces going to a theater. It seems, you know, people say, hey, theaters are dying. I disagree. There's nothing like that experience with popcorn, Coke, and taking a film in on such a large screen with other people enjoying it.
I'm a big fan of it, obviously, and I've seen this movie quite a few times with big audiences, with, you know, like 300-400 people in a cinema, normal cinema. And of course, the way people set each other off emotionally, you can hear the whole room reacting to a moment, and that's a sort of shared experience that I don't think you get off a computer screen.
No, I'm a big fan of movies. We actually had Cole Needham on a few weeks ago, the IMDb founder, who's
watched. Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So, guys, again, March 15th, Arthur the King. You know, Simon, anything you want to tell the audience that may get them off the couch and go, go watch this film?
If you've got a dog, you have to see this movie. If you don't have a dog, you kind of have to see it anyway, because it's sort of got so many things to attract you. It's got sport. It's got sort of chemistry between people. It's got animals. It's got extraordinary scenery. And let's not forget, it's about a bunch of crazy people who race for 5 days straight.
Well said, well said. Guys, I will say this. My wife was not the only one in tears during the film. So it's a good one. Again, heartstrings. Great, just loving, fun-loving story. So, Simon, well done. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I know you're busy, especially with the premiere or the release, the theatrical release coming up. And I wish you the best of luck.
Fantastic. Really brilliant talking to you, Mike. See you again soon.
Thank you. All right, guys. This has been the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. Out here.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.